Well, like the plants and the people around Wisconsin, our insect population is, I think, aware in some ways that the seasons are changing. And like us, they have a lot to get done before that first snow flies. Lucky to have Phil Pelletieri with us. He comes by every month to talk about the fascinating insects around us. He directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. Of course, the UW Extension Entomologist. And Phil, always a pleasure.
Nice to be here.
You have what kinds of things are you getting from a listener or from your people who contact the Insect Diagnostic Lab?
Well, this is the time of the year that we clump it as fall invaders. All these things that are trying to get
elder,
in.
Box elder, I'll bet.
Yeah, get into the house and spend the winter rent free. And, you know, there seems to be somebody that's going to have a good year every year. So box elder bugs are definitely the big one. Conifer seed bug is been relatively big. Interesting enough, because of the drought, cluster flies are way down, and that's a critter that typically comes in now, but because they depend on earthworms, and earthworms didn't do so well in the dry season. The other one, Asian lady beetles, are on very low numbers, and so, you know, we still have to keep the guard up, and the tough thing on the box elders is that, honestly, you would prefer to stop them a month ago. You know, what the fear is you'll still see them active, but the ones that have already gotten under the siding in the attic are not available anymore, and that's going to pose at least a nuisance problem in the winter for people.
We had a Facebook question from Sarah, who said about a month ago we had a swarm of tiny brown ants in our backyard. They were crawling along a piece of plastic landscape edging with rocks on one side, grass on the other. It seemed like there were thousands of them. Some with wings, some without. The next day, they were gone.
Yeah. So this is technically called a swarm. And it happens at different times of the year, depending on the kind of ants it is. And what you see with wings are the kings and queens. These are the reproductives. The common ant you see in your kitchen are sterile females that we call workers. And so the phenomena is at certain times, even of the day, and it's quite common for these ones that swarm in the late summer to do it in the late afternoons on a sunny day, you see these explosions of ants. And what supposed to happen is they'll fly down the road, find a reproductive from another colony, mate, and then they start everything from scratch. So the queens get fertilized in the late summer, but they won't start things until next spring. They basically store the sperm from that fertilization, and then they're off to establish their new colonies. And so it isn't unusual to see swarms every afternoon for like 4 or 5 days straight and then not see them again. So I'm guessing this is either citronella ant, one of the field ants, or cornfield ants, because those are the three ones that I commonly associate with swarms in the late summer. And of those, really none of them are strong, come inside type of ants. Once in a while, the cornfield ants have a little bit of a sweet tooth, but generally speaking, they're very common outdoors and they don't come indoors and cause problems.
There were some issues with, spotted wing fruit flies? Is that what they were called this year?
You know, I look at my career now, and it's defined by what invasives invaded in a given year. And the disappointment of spotted wing Drosophila, which is a type of fruit fly, is that we had records of it in the state. It's an Asian fruit fly that's been in the United States since about 2008, 2009. Our records start in 2010, but we caught fruit flies in traps, but no crop damage. What caught us off guard is by the middle of August, a good portion of the fall raspberry crop was just torn apart by this insect. And we have people doing high tunnel raspberries, so there'll still be raspberry production for a while. This is an insect you've got to stop before it gets in the plant. You know, once it lays its eggs in the fruit, within 3 or 4 days, the fruit falls apart. It's got little white maggots in it. There's no way we can stop that. And so unexpected, and we still don't understand if this was a blow-in or overwintering populations, although I'm leaning towards the blow-in just by the pattern that's going on. And we had so many other things blow in. But, you know, this is an insect we just didn't want to have because it's going to really change. In fact, some of the states where it has been well-established, the suggestion is do not get into commercial fall raspberry production anymore because it's so hard to stop.
So maybe if we get a good cold winter, would that be the kind of thing that would eliminate them maybe?
Well, no, only because fruit flies breed so much. The theory is always they can be brought in again on some semi that's been driving in North Carolina and the like. So, you know, as I said, it'll be interesting to see the pattern, but we're scrambling a little bit because this was unexpected, but both Minnesota and Wisconsin really caught quite a bit of pressure, but many of the states around us didn't, which is a very curious question.
Well, let's take some calls. Ojack and Shano, your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for the program, Larry, and thank you for taking the call. Just a little bit of background, please.
Okay.
We live most of our time in southwestern Ohio. We have three butterfly bushes and a stand of bee balm. Normally, we have had dozens of swallowtail and spicebush butterflies. This year, we had one spicebush and maybe one swallowtail and two or three spicebush butterflies, and that's it for the entire spring through the time we left there in August. Now, we've been up here since August, and through yesterday, we have seen no monarchs whatsoever. Our question, two questions we have really is this condition current in northern, eastern Wisconsin? And what do you think is happening or has happened to the butterflies?
Okay. Well, it's good questions. Now, I would tell you last year was an exceptionally good butterfly year for the whole season. We saw more swallowtails and the like. This year in the spring, it started pretty good. We had red admirals, and I saw a lot of swallowtails, and everything was 2 or 3 weeks early. Even the monarchs, you know, we were seeing early. But since that time, it has not been. It has been, I'm sure, drought-related, very stressful. I will tell you that I've seen some butterflies this year I have never seen in my career in Wisconsin. We had a zebra swallowtail that a person sent a picture from Columbus. I saw some dainty sulfurs in my backyard and was out chasing them with a butterfly net. And I don't do that much anymore just to see them because I knew it was something I had not seen. And these are southern migrants that blow in here. And so that fit the pattern of these strong southerly airflows that we had so often. But overall, it was not a good butterfly year. And even for the monarchs, even though they were up here early, you know, whatever the combinations that the drought pushed, overall, it wasn't a good year. But the good news about that is, you know, I've seen some reports from out in Western Canada, the populations are almost record breaking. And so it's kind of a regional effect. And of course, insects with a reproductive potential, we could be right back into heavy butterflies next year. So this does not mean, but definitely weather related. And again, it was apparently stressful for a lot of species, even though we have insects that have different times in life stages at different times.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't good for them.
Yeah. There you go, Jack. And hopefully they'll be back next year. That you can only hope. Dave and Madison, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I bought a maple tree from a big box store, and after I planted it, an insect either bored in or bored out, and the holes were almost the size of a pencil. It was a maple tree, but now they've spread to taking care of or getting rid of boring all my small poplars and maple trees. And I was wondering, is there some way I can stop this, and is it something coming in or going out? Is it too late?
What are the holes? Are they in a row? Are they...
They're random already. They're not in a row, but, you know, my mother's got one that is in a row. Now that you mention it like that, that they come millions of them on one of her trees. But on this one, there might just be five or six at random around one spot on the tree.
Okay, so more than one thing going on here, I think. For your mother, it's probably sapsucker feeding, which is a bird. There is a critter called a horntail, which is an insect that we normally associate with maples. But usually it's dead and dying trees because the whole issue is they don't attack healthy trees. Now, you know, overall, I am very concerned about how much drought stress we've had. And we're going to see wood borers just have a happy time the next 2 or 3 years unless we get a significant change in precipitation levels because our trees are so stressed for moisture. What's hard to say on the maple, the way the life cycles go, if you put this thing in June and you were getting them coming out in August, they were in the tree when you got them. There's no way that their cycles turn that fast. But again, overall, my comment on maple, not on poplar, because I've got about 10 things that bore into poplar. So I'm not even so sure it's the same critter in those two different trees. But in maple, if it's horntails, it just tells me there's dead wood in the tree. And I've seen trees survive this. It just means, as I said, they lay their eggs, their grubs develop in the dead wood. That's why they're quite commonly associated with firewood, too. It's trees that people cut. They bring it in, the insects develop, and you get this 2-inch long, about the diameter of a pencil. Looks like a wasp, but it doesn't have a real constriction to its body between its thorax and abdomen. And then it has what looks like a stinger that's probably a 1/2 inch long out the back end, which is an egg-laying device. So I said, if you do a search on the internet under horntail, you see a number of different species. But I'm not overly concerned as long as the trees are healthy. So again, watering, babying, and whatnot. So even the one you got from the box store, I think there's a chance that it will pull out of it, but it does tell me there's some dead tissue in that tree.
Mm-hmm. But you want to be watering
Yes.
Keep watering right up until freeze up.
Well, I do water the trees quite a bit, and it didn't kill the trees. What it did do is it turned them from a maple tree to a maple bush now, and that's what I've got. The top part of it has died.
Yeah, well, they were just, see, you know, the grubs, and it could be somebody else. I mean, if you look at any given tree, there's a handful of borers, and the horntail is the kind that attacks things that's already dead. Now, I do have other things like flat-headed borer and whatnot that will attack trees that are just kind of weakened, and especially thin bark trees like maple are susceptible to it. They work underneath the cambial tissue, and they basically strangle it. They cut off the moisture going up, the nutrients going down. So you can kill a leader, but if there are buds underneath it, it will push. Again, transplanting is a major shock. So already you're at a disadvantage. And even watering as much as you can isn't always enough. But overall, the water is more important. If indeed we find evidence of critters next year, there are some chemicals that you can consider putting on, depending what the critter is. But the difficulty here is trying to get exactly what the critter is, because the story is a little bit different from the flathead borer versus the horntail.
Yep. Got it. It's been going on for several years, though. But look up horntail and just see what I need to kill it then?
Well, horntails I normally suggest to people, because they're attacking dead tissue, is it worth messing with? If you were going to, you would basically put chemicals on the outside area they're attacking when they're flying, which is typically going to be in June and July. You know, so the permethrin-based type things are what you would think of. But as I said, horntails I'm not concerned about because they're not aggressive. If it was something else like these flat-headed borers in thin bark transplants, they can kill the tree. So that's a much more serious thing. And then the same kind of concept is we spray the trunk to protect it to prevent the critters from coming in.
There you go. Good luck, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. And William in Viroqua, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Larry and Phil, great show as always. Hey, I was having an outbreak of pantry moths and seeing some of the little maggots or whatever in some grains and stuff, and it was trying to get rid of them. And I found some of the things they were in, and one of the things that really surprised me was some dried peppers. They really seemed to like those, and they had run rampant through them. So I cleaned out most of the stuff, and I went to the hardware store, and I got some of those moth traps as well. And I was wondering if that's worthwhile going about that route with those little triangular-shaped baited moth traps or whether...
What the traps are useful for is telling you what the population is like. The disadvantage of the trap is they only catch males. So the trap cannot be relied on to eliminate the problem. But if the numbers of moths you catch continue to go down and disappear, that tells me your sanitation, which is the most important thing anyway, solved the problem. If you continue to see a trickle of moths after about 2 to 3 weeks of going through the cleanout, that's highly suggestive that they've still found something else, bag of birdseed back in a closet or some other food substrate that you didn't think about. And that's the frustration with these guys is that anything that's divided is dried plant material. So occasionally they'll show up in a potpourri or things that at first glance people just don't even think about because they're concerned about food products. And the dried peppers, yes, they have very different taste buds. And even the hottest peppers in the world, they could care less. They'll feed through it. So as I said, the traps are useful for monitoring, but as a control strategy, because they only catch males, they won't do the job.
Anything with what about cedar or anything else would make deter them, or is it just keeping on top of them?
Keeping on top of them by putting things that you have that are potential food sources in containers they can't get into. So screw top jars, glass, good sealing Tupperware, plastic bags inside a little cardboard box are not enough. And so you worry about things like pancake batter and other things that are around as a potential source. You can always put these things in the freezer for 4 or 5 days and kill anything that's there. But these things are notorious for doing an end run. And as I said, that's where the traps will help you, is it will give you kind of an early warning that they're still breeding. Whereas, sometimes it'll take 3 or 4 months without the traps, and all of a sudden you start to see this buildup again. But you go back to, if you don't eliminate the source, it doesn't matter what you got. And I really am not a proponent for spraying for these, because you can't spray the food, and it is a food issue.
Good luck. Thanks a lot, William, for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much. If you have a question for Phil, why not give us a call? The number is 1-800-642-1234. If you have a photo of an insect you'd like to identify, or maybe just got a cool picture of one, give us send that to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to have that as well. And, of course, email questions at talk@WPR.org. But we have open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Barb next in Superior. Hi, Barb. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Say about 2 months ago, I was looking. I have a majestic silver maple in my backyard, yeah. And there was a large caterpillar, perhaps around 3 inches long, light lime green. It had no fur or hair on it, and it had pegs on either side. Some were kind of a blue, some were like a maroon color. And the silver maple is a very healthy tree.
Mm-hmm.
And about, four years ago, I had seen another one, similar size, and I wanted to touch it, and it bit me. And I went online. I have not seen a similar picture of this caterpillar. Do you know what it could be?
Well, the size of the peg suggests it's one of the wild silkworms. I'm quite suspicious it is the Cecropia moth, but there's also a Polyphemus, there's a Luna, and many of those feed on various broadleaf trees. So I said you go under wild silkworms and look at the pictures of the caterpillars. Now, biting is not a normal concern with these critters. They do have little pinchy jaws, and if you get your finger there, they might try to take a taste out of you. And I think that's what they're doing. They're not. They don't have very good eyes. They're more sensory, and they're just eating machines. And so I think they were probably just kind of gnawing at your finger just to see what you taste like. But as far as anything more than a little pinch, I don't expect any problems, because they said that's when I think of wild silkworm caterpillars, biting is not something that comes to my mind.
Okay.
So neat critters, they spin cocoons down. That's how they get through the winter. The moths emerge. The moths are big, showy, very short-lived. They don't feed as adults. And many times the bats do them in very shortly, so they often only live 1 or 2 days.
It was absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
So it would not harm the tree.
Oh, no. They eat a few leaves, never enough of any consequence. It's more of kind of just a special insect to enjoy in Wisconsin than worrying about it causing any damage.
Yep. There you go, Barb.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Lisa in Green Bay, hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Okay. I've been made aware of a scabies outbreak in my daughter's school, and I'm kind of wondering how common this is and what concerns I may have with coming in contact with that and how you get rid of it.
Okay.
Scabies.
So scabies
what do we
got is
there?
Technically a medical problem because it is a mite. This is basically human mange. You know, people talk about mange mites in dogs. Well, there's a species of mite that is adapted to burrowing in the skin of people. And because it lives in somebody, that's where it becomes more of a medical problem than an entomological. But to give you a couple things, the mite does very poorly when it's not inside the skin of its host. And for that reason, it only generally spreads with close personal contact. And so we do find at times that, in nursing homes with, patients that get it and then the staff that work with it, there's a chance for transfer there. But it's not as near as contagious as some people would make you believe. And so just a few precautions there. Now, the only way it can be diagnosed, honestly, is with a skin scraping, because what they look for is the presence of mites. You don't feel the bite of the scabies mite. What you see is these interesting little tracks in the skin, and then they become very itchy, so people get more of a rash. And it's quite classically found in places that are somewhat moist on the body, so in between the fingers, in between the toes. Behind the knee would be a place you might expect to find it. And it's not easy to diagnose, and as I said, I'm always leery because in my career, I've talked to a number of people who think they have scabies, and I'm pretty much convinced they don't.
No.
But in the school system, what they will do is they'll treat the infested children with appropriate products. Be a little careful, you know, wash bedding and you know, in little ones. If you've got little sleeping mats, those would need to be at least put in the dryer under hot just because the mites can't survive that. But other than that, usually you don't have to be very aggressive. The biggest problem, I think, is the earlier side of it is if it just presents as a rash, people don't think of scabies as one possibility. But if somebody has verified it, as I said, and then you take the kind of precautions, it really isn't something I'd worry that contagious. So, you know, clothing the child brings home, you know, if your child doesn't have scabies, I don't worry about clothing. I don't worry about books, book bags, any of that stuff. It's not a way that you'd see scabies mites being transferred.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so nothing that you really need to have medical attention for, basically? Does it just go away on its own?
Oh, no. It can spread. And so, again, if it's diagnosed, then there is appropriate body washes, basically, that contain insecticide. In fact, often you have to put a second treatment because the eggs are not killed by the first treatment. And you have to be quite thorough. So the people that have been diagnosed, will be either prescribed, most often prescribed products for treating it. But that's what it is. It's an on-person treatment is the main strategy. And so, for everybody else, we don't worry so much.
So if it's a mite, an actual insect or mite, I mean, where does it come from? It only lives on human host, but then where does it actually come from?
From another infested person. So you have to start with an infested person that comes in contact with another infested person, and that's how it tends to transfer. So, as I said, so it does take a lot of close personal contact because the mite out in the open air and walking on a table and whatnot is in big trouble. It's too dry and whatnot. They die in a matter of minutes, if not hours, depending on the circumstances. So it's not as if there's mites crawling around in the classroom that the kids are exposed to. Now, on the other hand, if the kids are sleeping on a mat and a child was infested, and then the next sense. So it's a little bit like head lice, but in some sense, even less contagious than head lice, as far as I'm concerned.
There you go.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Lisa, for calling. And Maury in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Maury.
Hi. So my dog has fleas, and he's had them for about 2 weeks now. And every day he has the same number. I mean, we pick them off and we kill them and we vacuumed couches and washed and sprayed stuff. And we're kind of at loss as to where they're coming from now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so two things. Normally, the fleas I see on dogs and cats are all cat fleas. And so the name isn't quite as important. And the interesting thing is cat fleas are also found on raccoons and possums. Now, the flea's life cycle is that the adult flea, the biting stage, would prefer to stay on the pet. But where the fleas breed have a lot to do where the animal rests. And why this happens is when the adult fleas are feeding, they defecate this digested blood that we call flea dirt. It's a black substance, and it accumulates where the animal sleeps and rests. That's where the eggs are laid. That's where the maggot-like larvae are feeding. They go through, you know, 3 to 4 weeks, and then they spin a cocoon down. So the one possibility in this case is either the breeding's going on in, again, the bedding area of your dog, or in a number of times in my career, I found that the source was a raccoon that was nesting in somebody's chimney. And that's where the breeding was going on, and the fleas kept spilling into the living space and infesting. So the first place I would go to is looking at where your animal likes to rest, you know, whether it's on a couch or sitting out in the living room rug. And you can buy various flea sprays. Most of them contain insect hormones that prevent the eggs from hatching and the larvae from developing, and also an insecticide to kill the adults. And it's all about treating the breeding spot. You treat the breeding spot, you're done. And the interesting thing is with cats, life is far more complicated. It's the same flea, but it's the animal behavior. With a dog, the breeding site is often right out in the middle because the dog just loves to sleep every night on that rug, and that's the breeding site. The cat, if it likes to sleep back in a closet somewhere, that's the breeding site, and you have to go chase that down. You have to get in there and treat that site. So I often hear from people, I've set off bombs, I've sprayed, I can't kill them, they must be resistant, and the problem is they're not treating the right site. And you know where your animal likes to hang out, that's where you concentrate. If it was a little rug, I'd tell you, wash it. To be honest, that would prevent the breeding. It kills the eggs. It gets the dirt out of there. You don't see them breeding on vinyl floors because there's no place for the stuff to accumulate. You do see them breeding in rugs and in furniture because that's where things can. You know, you get a heavy nap rug, all that stuff filters down in there, and you can get the breeding in the rug, which somewhat complicates treatment because trying to get the product down there sometimes is a little bit of a bother.
Mm-hmm.
So if we've sprayed already, do you think it's beneficial to spray again?
No. If you spray the right spot, it should take care of it. If it doesn't get better, Now, one thing that will happen is the cocoon stage is not susceptible to the spray. So it's not unusual to spray and get fleas continuing to come out for 7 to 10 days. Eventually, when they get in the insecticide, they will die, or you pick them up in the vacuum cleaner. So you should start to see an improvement pretty quick if everything's falling into place. If it isn't falling into place, it's going to take a little bit more detective work to solve this one.
There you go, Mary. Good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Kirk in Prentice. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, we live up here in north central Wisconsin, and we have hazelnut trees or bushes growing absolutely everywhere. Trouble is, we don't get any nuts off of them. The little grubs move in there. Is there any way a guy could spray a few trees or something to get a few hazelnuts?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it's kind of like growing apples and whatnot. You have to be pretty aggressive pretty early because that's when the weevils are laying their eggs into the developing fruit, and then the grub kind of goes along with it as it goes. So you can find on the internet some suggestions. They're basically fruit tree sprays, and basically you're putting on a spray after the flowers have fallen, the nuts first start to develop. And then in very extreme cases, you could probably follow that up about 2 weeks later. But that's all you need is that early protection to stop the eggs from being laid, and then you're done with it. But it does take quite a bit of work, and you know, people talk about picking up the fallen nuts to help reduce the populations. It does help, but the critters involved here are just so darn mobile that by itself, the sanitation will not solve the problem. So, unfortunately, it means you have to be kind of aggressive early to protect the fruit.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. And how about you go back to some of our email questions? Joey in Sparta says, driving home on the evening of October 8th, there were many small moths in the headlights. From what I found in my car grill, the moths were a buff color with some darker lines on the forewing, perhaps an inch and a half in size. The area I was driving from Sparta East was a combination of pine and hardwoods, and then into all hardwoods and ag land. The moths were persistent for my 10-mile drive.
Mm-hmm. So they're in the inchworm family, or what we call the geometrids. But to be honest, there's a number of species that are active in the fall. There are canker worms, there are span worms, and without seeing the exact moth, I'm a bit of a guess. But what goes on is they're active very late, in many cases they lay their eggs, and that's how the critter gets through the winter. Then they hatch, and there are both pine-feeding species and hardwood-feeding species. In fact, this family alone, I'm guessing, probably has at least 150 to 200 representatives in the state. So it's a pretty big family.
Okay.
So I know it's an inchworm moth of one sort, and without seeing it, I'm guessing there's a Bruce spanworm. So he said, I can think of a number of them that are active in the fall. And some of these, like cankerworm, can be a little bit of a stinker in the spring because of the defoliation they do.
And another question about box elders, wondering how long they can go without food.
Well, they're not feeding now. They're basically in a hibernation state. And technically speaking, it's quite common for an adult to find a place to spend the winter, not eat any time until next spring, when we get into April or so, it finally warms them enough for them to be active. They are primarily seed feeders on things in the maple family, with box elder being the most prominent, but they will breed on silver maple and even to some degree red maple. You'll see not as successful, but some success. They also feed a little bit on the shoots of those plants, but they're primarily a seed feeder. So, and it's a mistake for insects, all these overwintering insects, to come into a warm house because they have limited energy reserves. And if they stay where it's cool, they don't burn those up. If they stay where it is warm in the house, it literally causes them to metabolize and they're not eating. So that's why it's quite common to see lady beetles and box elder bugs and cluster flies all die within a day or two when they wake up in January because there's no fuel in the tummy. So,
Don in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I came across an interesting bug last summer and somebody told me they were earwigs.
Okay, now if we're
ugly looking things.
Pardon me?
What part of the state are you located in?
Wausau.
Wausau, Wisconsin.
Okay. The only reason I ask is earwigs are not native to Wisconsin. When I first started in 1978, the only place we had earwigs is along the lakeshore in Milwaukee. And I always teased that thought I was so smart because I said, well, that's a lake effect. You know, it's just mild enough. And they have slowly but surely moved throughout the state. And so they got in the Madison in the 80s. And they got up to Ashland about 4 years ago. So there are parts of the state where they still are relatively new. They are an interesting animal. They belong to a unique group. Although they're related to cockroaches, they are not roaches. They are earwigs. And the species we have here is called the European earwig. One generation of ear lives in the ground as females that lay eggs quite early in the spring, but their nymphs, the babies, stay in the ground until about the 1st of June, and then they emerge. And they are active mostly at night. They feed on plants and insects. Interesting enough, I saw a study recently where they would much prefer to feed on an aphid than feeding on your hostas.
Oh.
So there's a good side of it. And I've teased before that they're kind of like goats. They eat anything, although I stopped saying that because one time when I was giving a lecture, somebody who raised goats was offended by my comment. But they're omnivorous. They eat a variety of things. When they come indoors on people, it's an accident. What it is they're active at night. And when the sun comes up, they're looking for cool, damp places. So they will sneak under the doors and show up. But they can't breed indoors. They really don't hurt anything. They're just kind of creepy for people. So they're really not that big a problem. We do talk occasionally in the garden. They'll feed on dahlias. They'll feed on marigolds. So once in a while, you have to treat flower beds to prevent their damage. But overall, they're really kind of a neutral critter, I think.
Oh, well, that's good to know because they are kind of creepy.
Yeah, they're creepy looking, that's for sure. Thanks, Don.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the help.
Yep, you bet. And let's go to Madison, talk to another Don. Hi, Don.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I've got a couple of apricot trees, a Manchurian one, and then a hybrid from Michigan State University that I got from Clint years ago. They're about pretty good size. I didn't really maintain keeping them trimmed down, and they've been bearing really great, except for the occasional year we get a early warming. But this year I noticed that they've got a lot of bore holes in them, and there's just, it looks, I don't know what sap looks like, but there's just, it's like snot coming out of the tree, this big black, oozy stuff. It's hard as a rock that's coming out of the tree within 4 feet of the ground.
Okay, so my first thought, there is an animal called a peach tree borer. Peach tree borer is a clear-wing moth. It is notorious for attacking the base of the tree, you know, the upper 3 or 4 inches, laying its eggs, and then getting this bleeding is the plant defense. The plant is trying to fight the fight. This can be serious.
Will the bleeding be up higher?
Well, it depends. There are other borers in this family that you could run into. And fruit trees in general have a list of them. It's a relatively big family of moths, and there's 3 or 4 of them you could run into in fruit trees. Now, the interesting thing about peach tree borer is normally I would consider that kind of a southern insect. But, you know, I've said this before, I'm seeing so many things move northward. So could you find peach tree borer in this area? Definitely.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a fight now, because there's caterpillars burrowing underneath that tree, and if they do enough physical damage to the trunk, they can kill the tree.
Well, one of them didn't bear any fruit this year.
Okay. As long as the leaves aren't showing a lot of stress and browning and dying, because, again, if you think about how they kill the tree, they basically prevent moisture and water from being translocated from the roots up, and that's why everything above it dies.
They're girdling it.
Right.
So what can I do?
The strategy for these, unfortunately, is it's all about next year. We can't do anything about the larvae that are in there. The base of the plant is treated where the activity is. So there's no reason to spray the whole tree. You spray the infested parts of the trunk. I would tell you this should be done probably about the first week of June next year. And the easiest product to find is something that's got a permethrin base. So 8 or the like, and you can read the label. And if you read the label carefully, you will often see they suggest a higher rate for doing this treatment than you would normally use for other types of things. And so that's something to look for.
Okay, because now the bore holes I'm talking about, they're a good 4 foot off the ground.
Yeah, that's still in okay, and it could be, as they said, if it's not peach tree borer, there's a lesser peach tree borer, there's a dogwood borer. The strategies are pretty similar. You know, in big
one
orchards. One application at the right time would do it. It's all about catching those adults when they're laying their eggs.
So in early June.
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had a cool picture on our Facebook page, Phil, from Lynn, who says we have two spider pictures. Mm-hmm. They were hanging out near my front door for a few weeks and one consuming a box elder bug for anybody who needs a little vicarious vengeance. I like that.
So the family are orb weavers.
Okay.
And this is probably in the genus Araneus, which is a big genus. And one of the interesting things when you look at these spiders is, first of all, they're always very colorful.
Yeah.
The abdomens are often round like a marble and are often brightly patterned with whites and cream colors. There's some that are even orange-based and browns and blacks.
Yeah.
So they're almost a mosaic. Another quite classical thing of many of these spiders is they have these banded legs, you know, the light, dark legs about them. And they always have these big webs, you know, that you think about for Halloween and spiders.
Yeah.
Common in the late summer. What you see typically are the females, and they lay egg masses that get them through the winter. I was watching the black and yellow version, which is in the genus Argiope. We had a couple in our backyard, and they make great photographic subjects. So they usually just sit there, and again, all the size, the color, it all fits pretty well. But they have their own problems, and so one morning we woke up and looked, and they're gone. And so, you know, whether they're wasps, birds, or other things that prey on them, the good news is they're harmless. The other thing is they're really not a spider that likes to come indoors, so people don't have to worry about that aspect of it. And so, as I said, I can tell it's in the genus Araneus, but after that, without seeing the spider, you know, I'm guessing there's a garden cross spider, there's a barn spider, so there's a number of them that you'd run into. It is a big group, but I enjoy seeing them in the late summer. As I said, I think they're very interesting animals to take a peek at.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Question for Phil, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. And if you have a great photo, we'd love to see that as well. Just go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you can see the cool spider photo that's there. And if you want to add one of your own, that'd be great, too. Olivia in Racine, thank you for waiting. Hello. Olivia, are you there? No. Oh. I think we must have lost Olivia.
Okay, well, she had a question about why spiders bite some people. And I will tell you that we find of when people wake up in the morning and find a bite and call it a spider bite, better than 90% of the time it's not. So there's a lot of complication here about what's a true spider bite or not. It is not normal for spiders to bite. And when they bite, there usually is not a whole lot of problems associated with that. You know, many spiders, they can't get their fangs enough leverage to bite. Some of them, the fangs are not strong enough to get through the skin. So as I said, there's a lot of reasons not to worry. And if you get multiple bites, I never believe that spider bites. But if one is in your shoe and you put your foot in there, yes, for defensive reasons, they can bite. And what's typical is if you look closely, you see two little fang marks. Then you'll often get a localized reaction because spiders are liquid feeders. They literally paralyze their prey. They have enzymes in their saliva that digest the prey and they suck it in. So if they get some of this venom into you, you can expect a localized reaction that I expect to look like a bruise.
Okay.
Now, one of the problems we see is secondary infections, whether it's spider bite or other related, are often presented. And so this, you know, we talked about in the show before, recluse bites that, you know, people talk about any of these sores and ulcerations that won't heal. I mean, they're really kind of tragic stories in some cases. And what it was found is that most of those cases, at least half of them, turned out to be staph infections and not spider bites at all. But they present in a very similar manner. And the argument in Wisconsin is recluse is such a rare spider, it's not found here, is most of the time one would assume, I don't care what the physician says, unless he did a biopsy here, and most of the time you find it's staph infection. So, as I said, it's not normal for spiders to come to bite. Once in a while, a confined situation, they will. And so then it goes back to is what is the person reacting? And that's the problem with bites is that, you know, patterns and timing of the year and where they're on your person and what you were doing all make suggestions of what the culprit could be. But I don't know anybody that can diagnose just a spot you've got on your arm and say this is such and such without more evidence. And I said the evidence for spider bites is the double fang punctures.
Bob from Marshfield wants to know how to treat grape phylloxera.
This is the insect that almost destroyed the wine industry in France. It is an aphid-like creature that has a very complicated life cycle. It's got a root form. It's got a leaf form. It causes little funny bumps on the leaves, which are the galls caused by it. And galls in general are not an easy thing to deal with. I will tell you that a native rootstocks, American rootstock grapes, have quite a bit of natural resistance. In fact, that's why all the grapes in France are grown on American rootstocks. That's how they saved the wine industry 150 years ago. Very interesting story there. So one of the things we talk about is removing wild grapes because that's a potential source. The other thing is, again, watch your grape lines. And as they said, you want American rootstocks that have some resistance. And if it finally gets way out of hand, there are some systemic chemicals that have registration on grapes. And why the systemics work is they're taken up by the plant sap and they're very effective against sucking insects. So the imidacloprid type products in very heavy infestations have registration for grapes, could be used. But I go back to is that normally you remove the wild hosts and whatnot. And this thing ebb and flows on its own. So we don't see a lot of serious problems with grape phylloxera, again, on a lot of our native lines of grapes.
Deborah in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Deb.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling.
Good. I was in Door County with my husband about a month ago, and we were hiking on a trail and saw these little white wiggly things. I sent you a video to talk at WPR.org just a few seconds ago. We took the video to the Nature Center, and the Nature Center person had no clue what it was, so we both said, let's ask Phil Pelletieri. So I don't know if you can look at the video. They looked like they were blowing in the wind. They were tiny, like the size of a pinhead. Mm-hmm. They were on a leaf or, you know, looked like a leaf.
Okay, well, I'm anxiously waiting. The video hasn't come up.
Did you put it on our Facebook page?
No, I talked to the screener, and she said put it on talk at WPR.org.
Okay, well, I don't think she's got it loaded yet.
Okay.
Okay. My first guess, honestly, is they're fungus gnat larvae, because they're behaving like fungus gnat larvae, but until I see them, it's a guess.
Okay. Well, it would make sense because it was on leaf litter on the forest floor, so
yeah.
If it was...
Yeah.
Fungus gnats have this interesting behavior that you will see lines of worms all kind of stuck together and moving in unison.
Uh-huh.
It's probably a behavior to prevent desiccation. You know, as they kind of all kind of intertwine and whatnot, I think they keep their humidity levels up, which is good for them.
Okay.
They're quite common in rich organic matter soil. This is also the little gnat that shows up in your houseplant soil if you're not careful, if you've got too much organic matter. And so that would fit. Usually they have quite well-defined dark heads and then little very thin bodies. I mean, you know, full-grown fungus gnats.
Are they bright white? These were bright white.
Yes, they can be clear or white body depending on the species.
Okay.
And so, as I said, we'll keep watching for this to come up.
Judith will have it up in a bit, and we'll...
Okay, if she puts it up after I hang up, will you identify it?
Okay, so it's the little white worms that you have a video of. You sent it. Okay, we'll... Judith will see what she can do.
For the subject line, I said white insect or whatever that needs to be identified. So,
okay. All right.
Kind of watch for that. Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you. I'll be listening.
Yep. Stay listening, Deb. And Chuck in Oconomowoc, turning to you next while Judith works on that. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Actually, I'm from Oconomowoc.
Sorry.
That's okay. I was listening to your spider stories and good information. My wife is the one who seems to be receptive of spider bites, and usually it's an evening situation where we'll be sleeping and she'll wake up. This has happened a couple times where she has gotten some kind of a bite, but the bite is numerous, and it's all in one particular area. It's to give you an idea about the size of a golf ball, and then the surface gets quite raised, and the doctor has indicated that it's numerous spider bites in that particular area. Is that a possibility?
No, I mean, I don't think so. As I said, I nothing against the physician's diagnosis, but you know, I've been doing this for 35 years, and in fact, one of my consultants, when I get perplexed, is a guy by the name of Rick Vetter, who's a spider specialist out of California, and you know, just knowing what Rick has done research-wise, you know, this is what makes this difficult, is that, you know, I go back to why would a spider go out of its way to bite some person numerous times and getting nothing out of it, you know, and so, you know, then I start to look at, and this is guesses, Now, you know, one would not expect bed bugs because bed bugs would only get worse over time. But I'll throw you a curve here. I have a species of bed bugs associated with bats. It cannot breed off of humans and the like, but given the opportunity, it will bite. So people who have bats in their house occasionally pick up mysterious bites. And one of the classic things about bed bugs is clusters of bites. So that would be one possibility. There are others. So a bat bug comes in, you know, falls in, picks on her. And we don't all respond to bites the same way. So who's to say you're not getting bites, you just aren't showing reactions. One of the other interesting things when you study insect bites is it's not unusual to get delayed reactions of up to 48 hours. So sometimes what you assume happened last night could trace back to being outside and exposure at a different time. And that's what makes it kind of hard putting the parts of this puzzle together. What I suggest for folks that get into this reoccurring problem is, again, we've got to hunt down the culprit. And probably the easiest way for most people to do monitoring is they sell what we call glue boards. They sell versions of this for catching mice and rats, which are bigger ones. But it's basically just a piece of sticky cardboard-like material. And you can get these in hardware stores, and I've seen them at the big box stores occasionally. And you put it under the bed or you put it on the windowsill. And the whole concept, if anything's crawling, jumping, flying, they get stuck on the board. And then if they get stuck on the board, you can send it off, take a picture, so somebody who knows what they're looking at can give you some idea, yes, this is something that is capable of biting, and then depending what it is, how do we address it? But the other problem is that, you know, there are things that cause reactions that look like insect bites or not. And so, again, I know for a fact that when this happens reoccurringly on a patient and whatnot, one of the potential ways of looking at this is for a dermatologist or other physician to do a biopsy and see if they can find the culprit. And now, normally, they're not going to go to that extreme if you just occasionally show up with something. But if there's this ongoing problem, that's another thing I think that often needs to be followed up on rather than making it. I'm sure it's an educated guess on his part, but I can tell you I have never seen it in my career, and I deal with bugs all the time. So,
it's happened a couple times, and sometimes that's what they said it was. And,
This is where entomologists and physicians get into a little bit of a tizzy, in that they've had 3 hours of entomology in their medical training. And, you know, I know you react to symptoms. I do, too. Even when I'm looking at a sick plant, I react to symptoms. I have guesses. But in this case, we need physical evidence. And as I said, there's nothing you've told me that's given me the physical evidence to suggest it's spiders.
Mike in Kenosha, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. My question is this. First of all, you know, it's about spiders, and I admire spiders, and I don't want to harm them here. However, a little domestic problem. We have a front porch where we sit out often, and the front door is there. And we get a lot of spider webs that form over the door and that type of thing. So I take the broom and I sweep them away and everything. But I'd like to know if there's some way where I can keep that area clear without resorting to insecticides and so on.
Well, a couple thoughts. The first thing is that where's your security light versus that door?
Right next to the door.
That's the problem, first of all, because, of course, it draws insects in, and that's what spiders eat, and so spiders are just to take advantage of a nice environment you've set up for them. So one of the things that we suggest, like in a food plant where they have basically zero tolerance for any kind of critters, is that you can take the light, put it on a post, you shine it on the door, so you still get the security effect, but the insects are drawn to the post away from the building. So that is a way to help out.
And it's full of insects, that light, you know, all the time.
Right, right. Now, the other thing you can look at that would maybe not as extreme or costly is to change the bulb out, in that there are certain light frequencies that are more attractive to insects, and of course there's some that are less. So some of the sodium vapors and whatnot are lights that will attract less critters, less spiders. So that is another option to take a look at. But
sodium vapor, okay.
Right. Yeah. And so those would be the two suggestions at first. Now, interesting enough, there's a chemical on the market that supposedly makes it more difficult for spiders to attach their webs. You know, an interesting thought. It works to some degree, but will it give you a night and day difference? No. So I think it's more reacting to the physical situation and changing it to be less attractive to spiders. The other thing is when you finally go after them, I would take a shop vac with a good attachment and get up in the seams and cracks. Because when you're brushing things away, all you're doing is taking the webs, and the ones that are hiding up in the cracks are still there. Yeah. At least with the vacuum cleaner, you're removing the spiders out of the environment.
Mm-hmm. You're right. They're there because I see them running away from my broom.
Right. Yeah. Right.
There you go, Mike.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. We do have up now, Judith's getting up that, we're waiting for that video to upload, so we don't have that yet, but some nice photos, one from Gerard, Odonatus.
Dragonflies.
Yeah.
And, yeah, a neat critter. This critter should get much more good press. You know, they talk about purple martins and mosquitoes, and the real mosquito eater out there are the dragonflies. Again, they didn't have the best year. There are a lot of ponds that they normally would breed in dried up. We do have a couple migratory species that literally will blow in here next spring. So they will recover from this, but generally dry years are not good for dragonflies because their immature stage lives in the water, which is also a predator in the immature stage. And they will feed on mosquito larvae also, but the adults are very mobile. They like little natty things to feed on, and that includes mosquitoes.
And Julie sent a great photo of an orb weaver spider, too, that she took in the prairie this fall. So
yeah, one
cool
of the great things, I have a picture that somebody was nice enough to send me from up in the Green Bay area a few years back. And you go out on one of those dew-filled mornings, and it was just thousands of these out in a prairie.
Oh, man. Phil Pelletieri will be with us right up until 12:30 today. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. With fall definitely settling in, there's a lot of insect going on outdoors, and summer's setting up house indoors as well. You may not be sure what's cause for concern and what's just an inconvenience. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Lucky to have Phil Pelletieri, our UW Extension entomologist, for the next half hour to talk about the fascinating world of insects. Lots of great information to share. He'll answer your questions as well. When you call in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page. We've got a lot of great insect photos up already. You can post your photos and your comments there. That's at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you click like while you're there, we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. So please do that. We'll be back with Phil right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Insects are really fascinating. They do a lot of good. They pollinate key crops. They even eat other insects that do a lot of damage. And a lot of insects like the emerald ash borer can be real problems, or this year's spotted wing fruit fly, very difficult to contain and can, as I said, really cause problems. Phil Pelletieri, director of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. He's with UW Extension. It's always great to have him come by and talk with you and with me about what's going on in the world of insects. And Phil, always great. Thanks for spending time with us again.
Nice to be here.
We have a video that came up that someone sent us of what she thought were...
Yeah, we thought they were little white worms, which I suspected were fungus gnats. And after seeing the video, it's... Oh, what critter that's posted here is an aphid. It's called a woolly aphid, and they secrete this little white resiny mass on their backs. And one of the interesting things about these is that they can move in unison, and so it's almost like waves. Now, typically, you'd expect to find this on a beech tree, and so I assume these are beech leaves. So it's more common on a green leaf than the ones on the ground, and I've seen some great ones. It's almost like they're dancing. I mean, you get a good enough video of it, and the way they're all swaying in unison, it's spooky. But it's definitely one of these woolly aphids that we find on beech in this particular case. In fact, there's two species that will do this on beech. So,
and if you want to see those, the video of those, just go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to view that. So just please go ahead and do it. And that's at The Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Jim and Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm wondering, hedge balls. H-E-B-G-E balls. Mm-hmm. Do they work? And if they do work, how do they work? And what do they work on?
So this is the fruit of an Osage orange. And the folk lore about them is that they repel spiders. And so when people did the testing, it's true that if you extract the chemicals in here, and it's, you know, kind of a organic soup, that it does have some repellency, but that's only the extractions. And so the concept, if you put one in your kitchen, all the spiders are going to run, is not true. If you extract the oils from the hedge hog or the Osage orange ball and then spray it in an area, yes, the spiders will move away. So it really isn't very practical when you get down to it. So it's one of those cases that there's a little bit of scientific truth, but the way it's kind of evolved is people give it far more credit than it at least can scientifically be proven.
Well, I've used them for a couple of years now, and I had a couple windows in a small apartment that only had two windows, and I put about three of them in each window.
Mm-hmm.
And within a matter of days, it almost seemed like the spiders just decided to find somewhere else to live. So you're telling me that that was probably just a lucky coincidence?
Well, it's just a question of how much of the liquid that's inside the ball came out. I mean, that's the problem. From what I've seen is it's an extraction that tends to have some efficacy, whereas an intact hedge ball does not.
Okay, so when I put them down and they kind of start to ooze a little bit, that's when they're doing their best.
Right. That, yes, anything. But then I'd be a little concerned if it leaves a stain on the windowsill. I'm not sure, but I'd be a little suspicious it might.
Yeah.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Jim. Dan Webster sent us another photo on our Facebook page and wonders, found this bug in August. That's interesting.
He was right. He's got it listed as a water bug. It's technically the giant water bug. It is a family of true bugs. They are aquatic. They live in the water. There's both this big one, which is the genus Lethoceras, and then there's a smaller one called Bellostoma. And one of the phenomena that is these things will, if the ponds dry up, they got to find someplace else to go, or it's quite common in the late summer for them to migrate to big bodies of water, like lakes and whatnot, because they're going to have to spend the winter there. So they're attracted to lights. And yeah. So another name for them is electric light bug. I've seen a reference of, although it's technically not the correct name. So you can find them in odd places, like next to the garage, because you've got a security light that drew them in and the like. Interesting critters, one of the bigger insects in the state. I'll tell you, you got to be a little careful handling them because this will give you a bite that will get your attention. They're predators. They feed even on small 4 or 5 inch fish. So you can imagine their bite does have a little bit of a wallop to it.
And it's an interesting looking bug for sure. So that's, again, something to look at on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Gary in Boscobel, hello to you.
Thanks, Larry.
You bet.
I've got two comments. One is connected with dragonflies, and I was watching some. I live out in the country in an old farmhouse, and I had a colony of ants that were leaving a nest in the ground and flying into the air to disperse, and these large dragonflies had homed in on these ants, and they were picking them off really fast, you know, and as I watched them, I could see that the dragonflies were dropping something. So I put a tarp down, and what I found was that the dragonflies were just biting the abdomen off of the emerging ants and then dropping the thorax and the wing parts onto the ground, which I thought was amazing. They were just taking the soft parts of the ant's body and feeding on that. I was doing some hiking on an old abandoned road on the south end of the Kickapoo River this summer, and there was a place where the old road had kind of cut through a little sandy bank. And on that sandy bank along there, there was literally thousands and thousands of exoskeletons of millipedes. It was almost like a miniature elephant graveyard where these millipedes seemed to be, for some reason, congregate there and then die. And I don't know if that was over many years of time or whether it was in one season. When I looked around, there was just a small handful of live millipedes there, but just thousands of skeletons of dead millipedes, and it was a kind of curious situation.
Well, both references that the outside skeleton of an insect is very plastic-like, and it does not degrade easily. Now, it's also not digestible. And there's nothing there, really. And so that's why the dragonflies were smart enough not to go chewing on the wings or the thorax, where there isn't a whole lot of stuff that they can utilize, whereas the abdomen has a lot more fats and soft tissue. And the millipedes, if I had to guess, a lot of that accumulation was from last year because we had just incredible plagues of millipedes in some areas. And, when you get lush conditions like we had in 2010, lots of organic matter, that gives you lots of millipedes. And they go through this phase sometimes where they just are dispersing, looking for, I don't know if it's an overpopulation is what we assume. And they can travel hundreds of yards, but what happens when the sun comes up, they look for places that are cool, damp, and dark to accumulate. So there are places where they just pile up. Now, you know, if that was next to the side of somebody's house, I've got pictures that people sent me last year of millipedes 4 inches deep along the north side of their house.
Oh, boy.
But the same thing here. If you get into an area, you know, north-facing, has some moisture, I can see where they would tend to accumulate there. And then if they die, those skeletons will just stay intact.
Hmm. There you go, Gary. Thank you very much for calling. I got an email from Tad in Ontario. It's kind of interesting. He said, I'm driving along and a lady beetle has been hanging on my windshield. How can they do that at 60 miles an hour?
My old professor, Dr. Robert Dick, who taught morphology, and so that's, you know, all the different parts of insects. He used to explain, you know, how insects can walk up smooth surfaces. And one of the phenomena you take is take a piece of paper, put it on a desk or a tabletop and add water to it. And then try to lift that up. And, of course, the surface tension is so much more. And so that's what you see on many of these insects is they have little pads on their feet that either have sticky areas or moist areas. And when they put it, it allows them to get enough surface tension and grip, more so than claws, of course, because a claw isn't going to do you very good digging into something that's as smooth as a windshield. But this phenomena of those pads. So as I said, usually when you find things that can hang on pretty well, that's what it is their feet. And flies do the same thing. They hang on the ceiling upside down because they have these little pads on the feet that stay moist, and that gives them enough surface tension that they can stay attached.
I have every year I have a spider that resides in the rear view or the side mirror of my car and comes out, and it's the same. It's not, it can't be the same spider, but it's the same species every single year. And sometimes, you know, you're going along 60 miles an hour and they're flapping around in the breeze, but hanging on.
Yeah, of course, spiders have those webs they can attach. And so it's kind of almost like a climbing rope that they can hang on to.
Oh, a lot of fun. Rebecca in Platteville. Hello.
Hi. I took advantage recently at a local box store and bought some clearance nursery stock. And the last of the 7 roses I planted, when I dumped the pot out came all these grubs. They were like macaroni size. They were curled like a C. The body is white, and the head was kind of creamy. Mm-hmm. And I killed all I could find, but there must have been a good 15, 20, and I'd already mixed dirt. So I don't know if I've missed them. I missed a couple. I don't have any Japanese beetles out here, so I don't know. Could that be what they are? And if not, if they is, how do I prevent them from emerging from the ground next year
to get ahead of the deal?
I don't know what these things were.
What complicates this is that I'm pretty comfortable saying it's a scarab beetle grub, but all scarab beetle grubs look alike. And the ones that we normally talk about on the show are things like Japanese beetle or June beetle, May beetles, because they cause plant damage. But the family as a whole is more often associated either with decaying organic matter, and in some cases even decaying animal feces, the dung beetles. And I can't tell you, it could be that they just mix some cow manure-like substrate in with, you know, the potting mixture, and that would support these kinds of grubs we associate with decaying organic matter rather than being white grubs. And I can't, you know, unless I saw the specimen, I literally have to look at the shape of the hairs on the back of the abdomen to tell what kind of species it was. Now, if this stuff was imported from other states, which is most likely, they're supposed to be inspected by state nursery inspectors that give them a clearance to cross state lines. Or if there's Japanese beetles there, they need to be treated in an appropriate way to kill the grubs before they can go. So that is somewhat of a protection. Now, I still see occasional nursery stock come in with Japanese beetle, but my first guess with that background is that this is associated with, you know, whether they use decaying leaf litter in with their potting mix or more cow manure that was well decayed, all those things would support very similar looking white grubs. And that's what I'm guessing you had.
Good.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rebecca, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Joanna in Loganville, your turn now. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. My family and I went to Yellowstone National Park this summer. We were there in late August. And we saw an insect that we were very curious as to what it was. We meant to ask someone, but then we forgot. It was on the ground, mostly on a hillside, and if I had to describe it, I'd say it's a cross between a cricket and a grasshopper because it was kind of making a cricket-like sound. But they were huge. They were like 2.5 to 3 inches long, and the body was like the size of my thumb, if not bigger. Mm-hmm. And it looked like it was injecting eggs into the ground there. Mm-hmm. We're just curious if you might have any clue what that was.
Go on the internet and look under either Mormon cricket or Jerusalem cricket.
Okay.
These are quite common out west. In fact, there's a very interesting story about the Mormon crickets eating all the crops, and they prayed, and then the seagulls came and ate them, and so there's a statue of seagulls in Salt Lake City. But they are a creature is associated with the West, and they do lay their eggs. That's how they get through the winter in the soil. And then the adults are foliage feeders, and at certain times you get major outbreaks of these things, and they're big. And some people would argue they're ugly because they're it's a pretty hefty size, but they're kind of an interesting creature, and I'm strongly suspicious it was in that group.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Back to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. A really beautiful photograph here of a caterpillar from Owen, and what are you thinking that caterpillar is?
Well, I'm really comfortable in saying it's a moth caterpillar, probably in the Noctuid family, but I can't take it farther than that without my library. there's a great book called The Caterpillars of Eastern North America that has pictures of lots of caterpillars, and now there's honestly another version from the same authors of the owlet moths, which is another name for the Noctuids. And there's literally hundreds of species, and so I would have to go through one of my reference books to give you a species name. But I said I know it's a caterpillar, and with that size and coloration, it's one of the Noctuids.
Richard in Winona, Minnesota, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I do a lot of brain tanning and stuff of deer and bear and whatever I can find, and I've noticed that there's these certain bugs that sometimes get into the hide and eat the flesh off and make the hair slip. And I was just wondering what those are. Is there any way to protect against them? Because they seem like when they're on the land, you can't really get rid of them.
Okay. Kind of brown, fuzzy little worms?
No, they more look like little cockroaches almost, and they leave behind like an exoskeleton, it seems.
And see, what I'm guessing is that they're what we call hide beetles. The carpet beetle and hide beetle family, the Dermestids, it's more the larvae than the adults that feed on high-protein food sources. So larder beetle would be one. And so the question is in those hides, you try to make sure you have as little and hopefully no muscle attachment. You know, if you got a clean hide, there's just not enough protein for them to normally mess with.
Right.
But if you've got a little piece of dried up muscle tissue and whatnot, that will start it. And then, you know, for them to plow through the leather, that's very, you know, when they're going from one place to the next, they eat all kinds of things, and I could see where that would cause some problems. So, you know, the cleaner you can get the hide before you get it through the tanning process, the better off you're going to be.
Do you know, do they fly on those things? Or do
well, the adults up? Do. Yeah, the adults, in fact, you know, when I find them in people's houses, I either associate them with things like dead mice or things that might be in the wall. Or another source of high protein are things like dead box elder bugs and lady beetles in the attic. And so we do have this problem. So they're always somewhere. Now, you know, I've got a bear hide downstairs and I got an elk hide downstairs that I self-tan. But, you know, I was lucky enough that things were clean enough that I really don't worry about them attacking those. But as I said, there is just absolutely no muscle tissue on those hides, and because of that, I can't see them being attracted to it. And once they dry, too, it sometimes need a little bit of moisture, although it's amazing how I've seen these things survive in some conditions I think were pretty hostile, and they just keep
managed.
Limping along.
Yep. There you go, Richard. I'm sorry, what?
Do they survive in the cold?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, one of the things you might consider is adding a borate product. You know, that's one of the reasons sometimes you wash some of these skins with. The boric acid is a borate solution is a stomach poison. So if there was something that you missed and they fed on that, it would kill them. And so that's I've seen in some cases, again, in the process of tanning hides and whatnot, they will use a borate solution as a final wash. So then when it dries, there is borates in the tissue. And as I said, the concept there is it's a stomach poison.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. Leslie in Elgin, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I looked at these bugs that are all over my house. They look like lightning bugs. I think they're soldier beetles, and they're everywhere. They're driving me crazy. Do they do any harm to my house? They're not inside. They're all over the outside.
I would look under box elder bugs, and I'd look under western conifer seed bug, because I have never seen soldier beetles this late in the season congregating. You see a bunch of them on your black-eyed Susans in August. But they're not a critter that should be around right now. So as I said, I suspect it's something different. This is a case that, you know, I always offer to folks. You know, if you can take a decent picture and email me, I'd be happy to look at it and verify. But my first guess at this time of the year, things clustering. And there's some similarities, kind of a long, skinny insect. But the box elder bug is a reddy orange and black, whereas the soldier beetle is more of a light yellowish orange. And far more a lot of that and very little black, whereas the box elder bug is a lot more black with these kind of highlights.
They're definitely black with the red stripes. So,
yeah. These are box elder bugs trying to spend the winter.
Do
and so they're a nuisance. You know, they don't hurt much, but if they get a chance, and it depends how tight the house is. If things are real tight, they can best get under the siding and don't show up. But if the house is an older house that has a lot of cracks, they work up underneath the walls in the attic, and then when things warm up, you'll see live box elder bugs in the middle of January. You know, if the south side of the house gets sunny and the heat from the house, they think it's spring, and so they're a nuisance. And that's when people call me, I have to be honest. I said, other than vacuuming, you can't do anything because I can't kill the ones in the walls because I can't get to them.
Right. Okay. So. All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And there's not much you can do. You can't control them now.
I mean, if you can get to them. So, you know, one of the things we've talked about is soapy water solutions are quite effective.
Sure.
They kill on contact, although I still love this story. And this is, you know, from a years ago we did this show. My colleague Don Lewis down in Iowa State always said a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water. And so I often suggested that as an option. We're doing the show and somebody called up and said, I tried Cheer and it didn't work. Uh-huh. Well, it turns out different detergents have different soap chemistries. And be honest, the only thing that I know works is the insecticidal soap, because that's the right stuff. Whereas the home remedies, it's a little bit of a guessing game. The other disadvantage of the soap is there's no residual, whereas there are sprays you can buy at the hardware store that if you spray on the south side, it will kill them for the next 3 to 4 weeks. The frustration, though, is if they've already got underneath something, you can't get to them.
Too late. Josh in Madison. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I had a question about spider mites in an indoor garden, and I was reading somewhere in one of the grow journals about using organic ways to get rid of them, and one of them was using predator bugs,
yes,
such as praying mantis.
Well, no, mantids, I wouldn't waste. You can't get them at this time of the year, and they don't waste their time eating something as small as that. There are predaceous mites that are used in greenhouses and plantscapes that are predators. You're going to have to go on the internet, look around. Arbico is one of the companies that sell them, but there are many other ones, and they'll ship you the mites. You let them go, and they will take care of spider mites. But the thing you got to pay some attention to is the environmental conditions you've got, because there's different mites that do well at different temperatures or different humidities. So that's why I would go to a site like Arbico, where their people have more than one mite predator, and they will match the best species to your situation.
Okay, so you're thinking humidity and temperature.
Temperature. You should be able to, you know, you can call up their customer service people, say, this is what I got, what do you recommend? And they will best match. So basically the ones in Arizona, because of the drier climate, are not the ones that necessarily do well here. In a tropical house that's 95 degrees is different than our houses that are, you know, 70 degrees. So
there you go. Thank you for calling. Danielle and Rhinelander, a quick comment or question?
Yeah, we made a pet out of an orb weaver spider that took up residence by our back porch light. And it's gone dormant before, like gone up in the corner and not come out for like 3 weeks at a time. But it's been a month, and I don't know if it died or if I should sweep it down or just leave it alone.
Well, you know, most of those species don't survive the winter. And so it's just a question of, you know, there are some spiders that go to 2 to 3 years in a life cycle, but most of the orb weavers are a 1 year life cycle. I would leave it alone. I mean, if there's an egg case in there or whatnot, you don't want to disturb that.
Yeah.
But just kind of wait and see. But, you know, if they have not been active on the warm days in the last month, that's a sign that it's just not there.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Phil, always a pleasure.
Nice to be here.
Oh, great to have you. And you'll be back in
a month.
About a month, and we'll do this all over again. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist with the heads up the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he will be back in a month and we'll do it all over again. Just to take a look ahead to tomorrow, at 11 o'clock we'll talk about public lands and how important those lands are to us. Dayton Duncan wrote and produced the Ken Burns documentary, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. So we'll talk about that documentary and about our public lands at 11. 11:45, we'll talk with folks from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association about some challenges and opportunities facing those treasures. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.